Iran's leader calls for an end to the war in Ukraine, saying that the country is a victim of the U.S. policy of creating crises. Day 6 of Russia-Ukraine conflict. Ukrainian president says defending the capital Kiev is a top priority. Russia vows to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. And reports coming out of Vienna suggest a travel agreement between Iran and the signatories of the JCPOA shall include removal of all sanctions counter to a 2015 deal. Welcome. Top story this hour, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for an end to the war in Ukraine and singled out the United States and its policies as the main culprit for the crisis. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei noted that the U.S. feeds on the crisis it makes all around the globe. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is nothing but a mirage. He recalled how the Ukrainian president and the former Afghan president both acknowledged being abandoned by Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei called the U.S. government a mafia regime, saying that Western nations use science and technology to slaughter and plunder other nations. He said Washington is a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance. The leader was delivering a speech on the occasion of Eid al-Mabath, the day Prophet Muhammad was picked as God's messenger. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement is warning that the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine could have serious repercussions globally. Said Hassan Nasrallah says the Moscow-Kiev tensions are very dangerous. He believes the conflict is more than just a face-off between the two sides and has the potential to draw in the rest of the world. The Lebanese resistance chief also blasted the West for its double standard toward Russia. He questioned the role of the international community at a time when the U.S. was waging wars against Iraq and Afghanistan. Nasrallah said that Washington is responsible for what's happening in Ukraine, and the Ukrainian people are the ones who are paying the price for the conflict. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now on its sixth day. Major cities, including the capital Kiev, are being the target of attacks. An airstrike hit Kiev's main television tower in the heart of the city, knocking out some state broadcasting. Satellite images show Russian tanks and armored vehicles moving toward the city. The convoy stretched for more than 65 kilometers. Vladimir Zelensky says that defending Kiev is his top priority. He says that Russia must call a halt to bombing cities before meaningful talks on a ceasefire start. He also urged NATO members to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Representatives from Russia and Ukraine are expected to hold a second round of talks on Wednesday after the first round failed to yield any result. Meantime, Russian Defense Minister has promised to push ahead with the operations until goals are achieved.
The Russian armed forces are conducting a special military operation to protect the population of Donbas, to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The main thing for us is to protect the Russian Federation from the military threat created by Western countries that are trying to use the Ukrainian people in the fight against our country.
The Russian Defense Ministry says that the Ukrainian military's access to the Azov Sea has been cut off. Authorities in Mariupol say that a bombing of the city has left it without power. In the Black Sea city of Kherson, the Russian army has set up checkpoints. In Kharkiv, too, the central square was shelled by advancing Russian forces. Ukraine's emergency services say the attack left 10 people dead. 8 people were also killed in an air raid on a housing block. The fighting began on Thursday after Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation. The UN Refugee Agency says more than 660,000 Ukrainians have fled the country. The number of refugees continues to rise. In the meantime, Western countries are piling up pressure on Russia in response to its military operation in Ukraine. Britain says it has passed a law to bar vessels connected with Russia from entering its ports. The legislation applies to all Russian-flagged, owned, registered, controlled, chartered, and operated vessels. The UK also saying that removing Russia as one of the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council is also among options on the table. Meantime, the European Council president says the body will have to seriously consider Ukraine's request for the bloc's membership. Charles Michel has accused Moscow of geopolitical terrorism. He says the EU sanctions against Moscow are massive and unprecedented.
We have responded with massive and unprecedented sanctions. We imposed sanctions on political and military leaders, on oligarchs, on Vladimir Putin, on Sergei Lavrov. We are also taking powerful measures to severely restrict the use of the foreign currency reserve of the Russian Central Bank. We are excluding key Russian banks from the SWIFT system. And we are also imposing severe sanctions on key sectors of Russia's economy.
The West sanctions have targeted Russian energy sector too. More than a dozen European countries and Canada have also closed their airspace to Russia. In retaliation, Russia has shut off all 27 EU nations as well as Britain and Canada from its airspace. The U.S. has also expelled a dozen Russian diplomats from the UN mission. Moscow says it won't yield to quote sanctions and pressures.
In general, the United States is the main apologist for sanctions. They are big fans of sanctions. Naturally, their adherence to this practice has now spread to Europe like a bacillus. They believe that by imposing sanctions, they can force us to change our position. Obviously, this is out of the question.
Peskov also dismisses fake allegations that Russia targets civilians. Moscow says the West is pushing Ukraine toward war. Addressing a UN Human Rights Council session, Russian foreign minister lashed out at the European Union for supplying lethal weapons to Kiev. Sergei Lavrov accused the bloc of engaging in a, quote, Russophobic frenzy. Europe and the U.S. have approved plans to give more arms to Ukraine. NATO is also increasing its military presence in Eastern Europe in spite of Moscow's opposition. On Tuesday, 200 American troops entered Germany to back NATO.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. Bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea. Bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now, and they have to know this is, it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat, we had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal.
Since 2014, a new wave of tensions has arisen between Russia and the West. Several rounds of Western sanctions on Moscow and the U.S. withdrawal from key treaties with Russia added fuel to the fire. As threats of a nuclear conflict are becoming a reality, the question is how the two sides can defuse the situation.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbass.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the US, have taken. Former US President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then, if it wasn't willing to face the music?
The reports coming out of the Austrian capital indicating that an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA is within reach, provided the West agrees to make political decisions. Press TV has learned the Iran delegation team is adhering to its insistence that no agreement will be achieved unless all of its proposed conditions are met. Under a possible agreement, all sanctions that run counter to JCPOA must be removed. The process will take months for Tehran to verify, and before Iran completes the verification, the U.S. will not be able to rejoin the JCPOA. Also, dozens of Iranian banks, companies, and individuals will be taken off Washington's list of sanctions on the very day that the agreement is announced. Iran's potential nuclear capabilities will be preserved as well. The agreement shall come with a strong inherent guarantee that will protect it from noncompliance by other signatories. Talks over the revival of the deal have been in progress since last April between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Our correspondent Huma Lutsky has been closely following the Vienna talks on the revival of the deal, and I talked to her, and she laid out positions of Iran on the Western side, saying their talks have reached a make or break stage.
When it comes to these final stages, what the Western side is saying is we are going to either make it happen or just allow these talks to collapse within a week. This is what they're saying. The Iranians have been saying long that they're not bound by any deadline. They will go on as long as they see it's necessary, as long as it's required to make this deal sustainable. They are saying that they have this time restriction, and that by maybe a week's time, even less, they have to make up their mind about what's going to happen. So the importance here, what they're trying to say, is that Iran is the one who has to make a decision. But what Iran and Iranian sources have been saying is that Iran, up until this stage, has shown the flexibility that it was meant to show, and now it's up to them to make this decision. So it is a make-or-break situation.
Iran and Syria have criticized the U.S. for its sanctions policies against other countries. The criticism came during a meeting between Iran's deputy foreign minister and the Syrian president in Damascus. Ali Eskandarkhaji and Bashar al-Assad particularly condemned American sanctions against Iran, Syria, and now Russia over its military action in Ukraine. President Assad and Haji also discussed bilateral relations between the countries and the way to expand them further. They also touched upon UN-backed negotiations that have been ongoing for several years to come up with a solution to the crisis in Syria. The two officials stressed that those negotiations should go ahead without foreign interference. Israeli forces are the third Palestinian in the West Bank in less than one day as tensions are running high in the occupied territories. Amar Shafiq Abu Ifa was shot dead near the city of Bethlehem. Israeli forces are refusing to hand over his earlier in the day, four killed two other Palestinians in a raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Tuesday was declared a day of rage in Palestine, with demonstrations held across the occupied West Bank, solidarity with prisoners in Israeli jails. Protests were held in Ramallah, Tul Kerem, and Bethlehem, and other towns and cities. Israeli forces clashed with demonstrators in Al-Khalil and Beit Umar.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes. As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
China is slamming a delegation of former senior U.S. defense and security officials visit Taiwan amid heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing over a host of issues.
The will of the national sovereignty and territorial integrity is immovable, and whoever United States sends to show support for Taiwan is futile. China urges the U.S. to abide by the One China principle, the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, to stop any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman urged the United States to handle the Taiwan issue prudently and refrain from harming bilateral relations further. He also warned that Washington would pay a heavy price for its provocative behavior in the Taiwan Strait. Last month, the United States said it would work with regional allies to maintain peace and stability in the strategic strait. Beijing has time and again warned Washington against increasing military and political support for Taiwan. China considers the island as part of its own territory.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the position of the housing in the Islamic culture. What we see generally in today's world is that the house, or we can say like some people have penthouse, some people have bungalows, some have like big apartments, and some own a big, we can say farmhouses. There are different ways of obviously houses. At different categories, what we see generally is today this house has become a place of enjoyment, for example, like for spending time, and this place is more than what I need. This place is to show off the houses or the place where we live, the place where we own. It is more to show off our friends, our family members, our community, that how big house do I have, and how much money do I have. So this is what we see in today's world. Even when we look at the interior of the house, we can see clearly that it is all to show off. It is not according to needs. There are many things inside the house, and even the size of the house is too big maybe for some, where it shows that this person is clearly trying to show off and nothing else. And he just wants to show off his position, his state, his money. And that's what he aims from this house. And it is against the Islamic teachings. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture, and we said that in today's world, unfortunately, the house has become a place to show off our wealth, to show off our position or status in the society. And therefore, because we have such kind of houses, we do not have any relation with our neighbors. It has cut off our relations with the neighbors. Whereas when we look at the Islamic teachings, it emphasizes on taking care of your neighbors. In Islamic teachings, it says that it should be of a size which is according to your need. If you need a three-bed house, so it should be just a three-bed or a courtyard and the obviously maybe a TV lounge or something like that where you can have an easy life. But if it is more than that, which is, you know, we can see there are like houses
today they're on the sale, which have swimming pool, for example. They have other things as well. So all these things are wastes. Why? Because in Islam, it talks about justice. You need to have justice. You need to help others as well. If there is something which is excessive for you, you should not take that thing. You should not buy such a house which have something which is excessive. Rather, you can spend the extra money in helping the people, in development, in maybe raising up the society. You can use it in any cause. But if you're choosing a house, it should be enough for you, number one. Number two, it should be good. Islam does not say to live in the mud houses or the old houses. No, you need to have a good house according to the Islamic structure, and it should be enough for you so that you can have a happy life. And on top of that, you are not overruling or ruining some other's rights. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria and Afghanistan, all countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French president objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the Channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the Channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the Channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it and it capsized and they drowned this was last week. Yeah, and they just drowned and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yes.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure like, an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be just explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy, but it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific, and why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilised way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that, like, rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible for us because that's their border. And then the British government should taking care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
First, I suppose, used the word tragic, and it is a tragedy. Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated, or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts, is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK, or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part, because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess, so.
There's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think, obviously, they've travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to the civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago also I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 21st century.
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because if they... I don't know, that's a tough one, because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU over this, to be fair. It's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen a result of that this year, so I wish that wasn't happening.
If we start the war, obviously we are
I mean, we should be taking responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue. I think it's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, are they? If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, it's causing tragedies and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences, so you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens' Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause.
Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them, as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments, I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allowing them to make the crossing, letting people make something that's unsafe where they could possibly lose their lives is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths in a way by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved
in? I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happening. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans and as common man to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all as a collective need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the Channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the Channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, they should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything, do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good, so we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what their, like, what country they came from, but their life matters, so they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place, if they have come over risking their life, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French President himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings. Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.